Good afternoon, Mr. Dugan. My name is Tom Green. I'm the Executive Director of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. This is an interview in support of our investigation of the causes of the financial crisis of recent days. And let me remind you, Mr. DeVizi may have already done that, that since this is a federal inquiry, as you are more than aware, it's subject to 18 U.S.C. 1001, so we're you'll be presenting essentially statements to a federal officer. So I will be asking you some questions. If you don't understand my questions, please let me know, and we'll try and rephrase it to make it as coherent as possible. I think of this as an interview as opposed to a deposition, so relatively informal. If you want to volunteer something, please do. This won't be a sort of pure question and answer. What we're trying to do is just get a better sense of some of the topics that are important to us.
Okay.
And you have, I presume, counsel present, so I'm sure they will bar the door if I intrude into some important privilege, and of course we'll want to stop and take full cognizance of that. So I wanted to start just very briefly. Mr. DeVizi may have already gone through this a bit with you, but you have this very interesting background. I'm particularly interested in the period you were at Covington and Burling, which I understand to be circa 1993 to the time you were appointed.
That's right.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
And I'm just interested in your role. As I understand it, you were the head of the Financial Services Group or something like that?
Financial Institutions Group, that's right.
And what did that...
It's a practice area. It was a bank regulatory practice that did regulatory advice on financial institutions matters, did some legislative work and lobbying as well, represented a range of clients on all sorts of different kinds of issues, mostly regulatory.
Okay. And just offhand, did you have any involvement with a case called Smiley versus Citigroup?
I'm trying to remember whether I tended not to be as directly involved in the litigation that was on, although occasionally I would be asked questions or consulted with respect to it. And I don't have a specific memory of the Smiley case, although I was well aware of the case. I just can't remember. I didn't play a direct or leading role in that by any means, didn't sign the briefs or anything.
Okay.
I can't remember. Did Covington represent the main
I don't, I'm not
that?
Sure.
I don't think
I'm just curious.
It
sounds like
I don't
such
think
an
the firm
case.
Did that case. There are other cases, though.
Now, one of the parties, I can't suggest to you that this is accurate or not, but one of the parties to that matter who represented consumer interests suggested to us that at one point in time he was mistakenly invited to a session to help write rules here at the OCC. Did you ever participate in that way? In
what time period are you talking about?
This would be circa mid-90s.
Okay.
Yeah. Was there a, did you, do you recall?
I have no recollection of that whatsoever.
Okay, and did you ever have the occasion to assist OCC staff in the writing or drafting of rules?
No.
Okay. In your current role, is there any standard of practice in the agency in terms of inviting interested parties in to help draft rules or regulations?
Not to my knowledge. We've certainly got consultations with a range of groups and interests, including lawyers, on various matters, but to my knowledge, I'm not aware of any time that we've asked people to write rules.
Or come in and comment on drafts and things of that nature.
Okay.
And is there, as far as you know, any sort of written expectation with respect to interaction of agency staff with advocates on any side of an issue that you have jurisdiction over?
I don't think we have ex parte rules, that kind of thing. That's what you're talking about, as you would, for example, in a judicial proceeding, and the rules that are codified in 12 CFR, APA style rules. Those are the only things I'm aware of.
Okay. So as far as you know, there aren't any that would deal specifically?
Nothing additional to the normal agency practice rules.
And just in general terms, since I'm not federal lawyer particularly, what are the ex parte rules, just briefly? I mean, is there some?
I believe that they really only apply to when you have an actual administrative proceeding going on, a judicial-like proceeding.
Okay.
And I'm not aware of them applying in other circumstances. So we have an open-door policy more generally where we meet with parties from all parts of the spectrum, from consumer groups to banks to lawyers representing any of the above, and everybody in between.
Mm-hmm. And is there any sort of practice with respect to that? I mean, you bring in one side and talk to them, and then bring in the
it's
other
nothing,
side?
It's nothing nearly so formalized, but as a practical matter, that's exactly what we do. We try to talk to everybody about, you know, different things that are going on.
Okay. Now, again, in your role as an attorney, I'm curious, circa 2003, there were a couple of important advisories that were issued by the OCC with respect to subprime lending. Do you recall having a role with respect to that as an advocate or anything of that nature? Okay. Now, during the same general time period, and the time period being up to, say, roughly 2003, various efforts were, there were interpretive rules that dealt with or requests that were opined upon preemption of state statutes in various areas. Were you involved as an advocate or as an advisor on any of those things that you recall?
The firm that I was with, Covington & Burling, represented a number of clients involved in various litigation matters involving preemption.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally, I was by no means the lead attorney on this, occasionally I would get consulted or read a section of a brief and give thoughts on it, but it was definitely at the periphery.
Okay, and I don't want to intrude into any attorney-client privilege, but can you describe any of these? I mean, you took a public position, or you were an advocate in some way?
The one I remember most looking at was really not a typical national bank preemption case. It was a privacy-related thing involving the Fair Credit Reporting Act,
mm-hmm.
Where there was a separate kind of statutory preemption matter going on. And my regulatory practice involved advising clients on financial privacy matters. And so then I was very involved in the legislation in the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act that came up with the privacy provisions and in advising clients on regulations and other things, interpreting those provisions. And so I was consulted on that and my views, and I expressed my views, and may have written, but can't remember, on the subject more broadly.
Okay, fair answer. And with respect to Gramm-Leach-Bliley, did you deal with any other preemption portions of that statute, or...?
Dealt with a lot of different provisions in the statute. It wasn't directly on point. I worked more on the securities provisions in the statute for the clients that I was representing. But I was aware of others in my firm were definitely involved in more of the issues that touched on preemption and how it would affect litigation. But I was less directly involved in them.
Okay. And then up to the point in time you were appointed to your current position, do you recall dealing with any particular states on behalf of any of your clients?
When I worked on the privacy provisions, advising on the privacy provisions, there were various meetings that you were involved in, some of these multi-state groups,
sure.
Like the Tibet, and I remember going to conferences with Julie Brill and others to talk about privacy-related issues and the state attorneys general had positions on that. And that's the one area I remember most, but on others, I don't. I didn't really have any.
Oh, very interesting. And did you have a particular client at that point, or you were?
I had a bunch of different clients at that point.
Okay. Any that you recall and can share with me?
Yeah, the American Bankers Association.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a coalition of financial trade associations that got together for this purpose called the Financial Services Coordinating Council, and I provided technical advice. I testified before the California legislature on a number of occasions on their privacy provisions,
mm-hmm.
And did that in a number of other states, and that's where I ran into attorneys general who were also interested in this issue more generally, what was going to be done at the state level.
Sure. And were you,
Gramm-Leach-Bliley?
Were you ever involved in the litigation that related to the scope of federal law vis-a-vis California's privacy statutes?
The one I was just talking about, the Fair Credit Reporting Act piece of it, was okay. The one I was asked about, and I think my firm was involved in that piece of litigation.
Okay. Now, circa 2004, actually January 13th, 2004, this agency issued a very significant preemption rule. It's in 12 CFR 74009. Were you involved in the development of that rule and your advocacy role?
No.
Okay. How did you avoid that?
You know, they're different. We had a lot of people doing different things. I certainly followed it, read about it, understood it, but I was just not, you know, as directly involved in it.
Okay. And then there was likewise a fairly famous decision about the Georgia Fair Lending Act at the same time, actually the same year. Were you at all involved in that one on behalf of the nations of First Franklin or any of those?
No. No, not for another. I did advise some clients at the time on what was going on with respect to it, but I had no direct involvement in it. Didn't appear before the agency or anything else.
Okay. Sounds good. And were any of your clients affected by the Georgia decision? I mean,
at the time, I represented Freddie Mac, and they indirectly were affected because they, of course, purchased loans. The Georgia law was affecting them, so they were watching this and they were keenly interested in what was going on. So indirectly, I was asked to comment at times on what was going on in the national bank side, and so mm-hmm. I would provide, but had no direct involvement in actual legislation, regulatory reaction.
Sure. Did you have any knowledge, or do you have any knowledge of how the rating agencies became involved in the Georgia?
I do not.
McGilla? Yeah.
I do not.
Okay. And after the Georgia decision, did you understand that, or is it your perspective that that decision broadly preempted state predatory lending statutes? Is that a fair reading of the result of the Georgia decision?
Well, the Georgia statute did a lot of things. It was a very broad statute. It was styled as my recollection, as predatory lending law, but very, very far-reaching, restrictive things that a number of companies were very concerned about at the time. And I was aware that the law, when the interpretation when it was issued, would have that effect with respect to, as it was intended to, with respect to the Georgia law. And of course, Georgia changed the law. Passed a different law to address a bunch of the concerns that were going on as it related to other providers. That's my recollection.
Okay, fair. Now, there was a very famous North Carolina statute circa 1999. Mm-hmm. Was that also affected by the Georgia decision?
You know, I don't have a direct recollection of that being. I've known since then that they have made that point, and I have no reason to believe that's not true, but it wasn't something I was following closely at the time.
Okay.
Just to be clear on this.
Yeah, sure.
There was a lot of preemption work done at my law firm, but I wasn't really a part of that at all. I was very much at the periphery of it and mm-hmm. did a lot of work on legal matters and cases.
Sure. How big was the unit or the practice group?
Maybe 7 to 10 lawyers, you know, depending, and then, you know, when you did litigation, you would pull in people who developed an expertise and got a bunch of cases, so that it would be separate, not considered part of the direct practice group.
Okay, good. Let me show you a couple of documents here. I'm sure I brought enough copies, I'm not sure what you my body.
We've been marking documents. You want to do so on these?
Yeah, why don't we? I understand. Leslie Bridgman was very careful to tell me that we were on 11, so this is 12.
Yeah, that's what I have too. Yeah. This would be number 12. Dugan 12.
Okay.
Let me represent to you, this is an advisory letter of circa 2003. I've already asked you a question or two about it, but I just wanted to get your sense from the period and then your current sense as controller as to what this might mean. And then my first question is, there are two of these. There's a 2002, which is this one, and 2003, and this one is, this is two, and this is with respect to guarding against predatory and abusive lending practices. To the extent you know, does this apply only to direct lending by banks or their affiliates?
As opposed to?
The purchase of?
I don't recall. I thought we had a separate thing.
You do?
So I couldn't tell you whether this specifically was limited at that.
Okay. Fair point. Let me turn your attention to the second page under background.
Okay.
I think it's probably the essentially a portion of the second sentence, and their second full clause reads, a fundamental characteristic of predatory lending is the aggressive marketing of credit to prospective borrowers who simply cannot afford the credit on the terms being offered. Is that still basically the agency's view of what predatory lending is?
Says it's a fundamental characteristic of it. I think obviously it's a fundamental characteristic that people are marketing products that they've marketed loans that they can't afford to repay. And I think we do think that is at the heart of it. Now, that's different from if they end up, there are many people who get products who ultimately default on them. It wasn't necessarily a situation where they got a predatory loan. So I think there is a distinction between the two. We certainly see a distinction between the two.
Sure. And then let me turn you to page 7. I just want to pursue this ability to pay question.
Okay.
Just above the bullets, there's text, which basically reads, national banks are advised to adopt policies and procedures to ensure that an appropriate determination has been made that the borrower has the capacity to make scheduled payments to service and repay the loan, including principal, interest, insurance, and taxes. And then there's further text. But my real question here is, to what extent do these principles interact with some of the market realities that existed during the boom, specifically option arms and sort of option pay type plans that involve pretty significant resets 2 to 3 years after initiation?
So I think we became quite concerned about pay option arms. We, the OCC, in 2003, we started doing our examiners. We did a bunch of, came up through a formal horizontal examination, but clearly during that period, there were concerns about some of the products that banks were starting to consider offering, because payment option arms had been around for a while in the thrift area. And the risk layering that was going on created concerns in the field about whether these were products that both were ones that banks knew what they were doing and how they were offering the products, and whether it was something that the consumers fully understood. And it ultimately led to, very soon after I was appointed, this was an issue that bubbled up to me. And we were in the process of leading the other agencies in developing interagency guidance. I pushed very hard to get that guidance done and to have it apply not just to banks, because there is, this is an important point, a bunch of guidance the bank regulators put out tends to apply only to the depository institutions supervised by the companies. And this particular market had a ton of lending that was going on in affiliates that were not subsidiaries of either a bank or a subsidiary of a bank, which is subject to the supervision, but we're holding company affiliates. So it's a holding company owns the bank, separately owns a non-bank affiliate. And we wanted to make sure that this guidance extended to those entities as well. So we insisted that the Federal Reserve and the OTS agree that the guidance would apply not just to the depository institutions and their subsidiaries, but also to these holding company affiliates, which only they had the power to do. And the point here is that we were trying to get something with maximum coverage. We couldn't get at the state lenders that were not affiliated with banks, who were selling a huge amount of this stuff as well. But we could get at these lenders, which were big players. And so we pushed, and the really core thing that we were trying to push was that if you wanted to provide this product, in addition to some particular disclosures that were involved, because we were quite concerned about the payment shock, the potential for the monthly payment to jump up, and that the lending was done to qualify the borrower, not at the initial monthly payment, but at the later fully indexed payment. And that was the critical thing in that guidance that we pushed and succeeded in getting into the guidance. There was resistance to this in the industry, and frankly, among some of the other regulators, it took a while to cajole people to the finish line. It took about 10 months or so to get it done.
Circa, when did that, when was that initially announced, and when did it go final? That was 2000.
I think we proposed it in December of 2005, I want to say, not early 2006, and then it took all year for it to be finalized. But in the meantime, I had given a couple of speeches on the subject. We began, our examiners began communicating it to management that we were very concerned about it. And we followed it up after the guidance was issued with a horizontal examination of all our largest institutions, which is where this was most prevalent, to make sure that they were complying with the guidance. The result was we didn't really have much subprime, such payment option loans being offered in national banks, with one exception, which was Countrywide in the bank,
right,
not in the holding company, and they not long after that flipped their charter to a
OTS charter,
Federal Thrift. Yes.
Right. This raises sort of an interesting question, I think, which is, I understand what you just told me, but let me play this back and make sure I'm honest here. What you're describing to me, it seems to me, is originations of certain kinds of loans from a particular institution. But a number of those same institutions, the largest ones that you regulate, got into serious trouble with things like RMBS and CDOs. So the question here is, assuming that you did something with their originations, what, if anything, explains how it is that, for example, Citigroup wound up with billions in subprime securities? How did that work in this structure, or how did that happen in this structure?
Well, this is the subject of a big part of our other interview. You're quite right. They're different. They're related, but different thoughts. So the normal basic credit standards at origination is one kind of thought that we spend a lot of time on. Traditionally, I spent a lot of time on. And we did so here. I forgot to tell the end of the story, which is even though we succeeded in not having it done in the national banking system, some of the banks went out and bought thrifts through the holding company, which we did not have a chance to pass on, and brought it back into a company, Wachovia, being the one by Golden West, which eventually was the huge problem that caused them to come to the brink of failure in the end. But the traditional credit underwriting is a more, traditional place that we would spend our time as credit supervisors and the like. And the wrinkle here was that the products were different, and number one. Number two, that the market for securitization was now growing so dramatically, it was sucking off a bunch of the prime mortgages, the first mortgages. And so that created pressure on underwriting standards and pressure that the institutions saying, we're not holding these things. so it's not an ongoing risk to us. So you, safety and soundness regulator, shouldn't be as concerned about it. And if you force us to do stuff that others aren't forced to do, they'll just pull us out of the market. And that's part of the reason why we needed to have guidance that went across the board, so everybody adopted a common rule. Okay, I still haven't answered your question. I don't think payment option arms were one of the things that ended up in CDOs. They typically were more subprime. Like payment option things were tended to be more in the Alt-A space, some even the prime space. But that market, in a company like Citi, you had a big securities arm that was structuring these securitizations, creating them, looking for product, getting that product, and actually did not, in that case, get the product directly from the bank. Its subprime tended to be outside the bank, and then finally. But at the end of the day, they ended up creating some securities, in this case CDOs, some of which, the super senior tranches, which were thought to be very safe because they had credit enhancement support underneath it, were okay, and for, in fact, they weren't making much money on it. It was kind of the cost of doing the rest of the part of their business, but there weren't many interested buyers in those. They didn't pay, the yield wasn't very good on it. And they ended up, particularly through these liquidity puts and guarantees, the bank got exposed to a bunch of these and ended up taking it back on. I think it is fair to say, and as I've said in speeches, because of their very high credit rating, we did not, as supervisors, spend as much time on the risks of these things as, in retrospect, we should have or the institution should have. And that's one of the things we definitely identified as a lesson learned from the crisis and the steps that need to be taken. Of course, there aren't many CDOs being packaged in the market now.
That market has largely disappeared.
Yes, so, true. But the notion of relying on credit ratings without doing more, for particularly for companies that are in the business of assessing credit, is something that even for the credit rating agencies lost their own luster, but it's caused a whole reevaluation of how you look at those kinds of products, and rightly so.
Okay. But I just want to loop back a bit to...
On the RMBS side,
yeah.
There wasn't as much purchase of RMBS by banks that we supervise on an ongoing basis. It was the as investments. There's some, but the numbers are not that large. The bigger issue was the securities arm of these companies creating structures that would take the mortgages, package them up, and sell them to investors all around the world.
Okay. But I'm curious in terms of how, for example, this may be in the nature of a hypothetical, how an examiner would take a look at this kind of a document that says basically, if I'm not mischaracterizing that, you know, people should be able to pay for the mortgages they take out. And then he's looking at, for example, a Citibank situation in which they are building securities on top of just those kinds of loans. Is the perspective that this rule or this advisory doesn't apply to that thing, or it just, since it's an advisory and there seem to be cross-cutting economic reasons why it's okay, we'll not look at it? Or?
An examiner, it's not that they wouldn't look at the mortgage at that point, but these standards did not have to be, these standards apply to the origination of mortgages, not to securities purchase that the standards of the loans that were underlying it, however far removed from the actual tranche of the security, had to comply with these. I don't think there's any defense or question.
Yeah, it is. And let me just, and you may have already answered the question I'm going to ask you, but let me just.
But I want to be clear. They can and should be looked at for what kinds of risks they present to the institution at any time. Okay?
Now, this is the second of two. This was issued on the same day, as I understand it. And so this deals with avoiding predatory and abusive lending practices in brokered and purchased loans.
When we identify it, this is advisory 2003.
Dash 3.
Which is number 13, exhibit 13.
Right. And it's dated February 21st, 2003.
Okay.
As was true for the other one as well. So really my question here, at least preliminarily, is would this, as far as you know, if you don't know, that's fine too. Would this have applied to the purchase of loans for purposes of bundling money that get to RMBS or?
I don't know directly, but my surmise is that this was more aimed at the purchase of loans from third-party originators and brokers who did it, as opposed to purchases of resulting securities or interest in securities by an institution, which would be viewed as something, I think, different. But we can certainly clarify that for the record.
Okay, that would be helpful. Because my particular interest is, say, the RMBS unit at Citi is buying mortgages from every place, and they purchase loans, arguably, or mortgages that arguably are not consistent with the standards you'd set in your first advisory. And I'm just curious how that, whether this would bite there.
I don't know the answer to that. I think the answer to that is that the entity that was purchasing those securities was not a national bank. It was the affiliate that was the securities arm that was subject to the jurisdiction of the Fed and the SEC, to a lesser extent the state, but it would not be subject to that rule. Only the national bank and its subsidiary, when they purchase the loans, would be subject to this kind of entity. So unless they were involved in the transaction, it wouldn't apply.
Okay. I mean, obviously, you need to confirm this.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's right.
But assuming what you just described is correct, and no reason to think it's not, do you have an example of what that might look like? Is there like a Citi example or a Wells Fargo example?
Yeah, there's an affiliate of the company. So they've got the holding company, Citigroup, that owns the national bank, and also owns a security subsidiary that I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but very much an identified legal entity with a broker dealer subject to. And it was not a national bank, wasn't subject to federal preemption, wasn't a subsidiary of the national bank. And that entity did all kinds of things in securities trading. It's the old Solomon Brothers, when they purchased it. So it did all kinds of investment banking, trading, and a bunch of stuff. And one of the things that it did was engage in the structured securities and packaging of securities that involved loans. And then they would purchase those loans, not from the national bank. They may have purchased it from the holding company affiliate that did subprime lending, Citi plus Citi Financial, I'm not sure. And they may have purchased it from third parties that were not regulated by any federal regulator, but regulated by the state. I don't know the answer to that. So they would then purchase the loans, package them up as securities, sell them to third parties. And in the CDO examples, they purchased some, and then some of them found their way then back to the national bank.
Okay. Let me ask you a bit of a theoretical question. The Waters versus Wachovia decision seems to speak in terms of affiliates. That may or may not be correct, given
it's
the precise
only a subsidiary.
Only a subsidiary.
So I just have a chart here. And we will produce one for the testimony that makes this a little clearer. So it's important.
Let's mark this chart for KAD 14 now. We won't hold you to it in terms of the precise example. But.
Okay. So, at the top you have Citigroup, which is the holding company regulated by the Federal Reserve. And then underneath it, You have Citibank, which is the national bank, which we supervise, and you have operating subsidiaries of Citibank, which we also supervise. So I drew the circle around it. On the other side, as a direct subsidiary of the holding company, you have the securities firm, Citi, I called it Citi Securities, that's not the name of it, regulated by the SEC and the Fed. This is not subject to our regulation, even though it's an affiliate of the bank. Only the subsidiary do we supervise. The Waters case was about whether the subsidiary, which is a state chartered corporation, as opposed to this, which is a federally chartered bank, mm-hmm. we've always treated it as and regulated as if it were an operating division of the bank, but it technically is a state chartered corporation. Would this get the same federal preemption as the parent? Waters said yes. But if it didn't, give it to this.
Okay, that's very helpful. All right. Was there any significance when these advisories were issued that they were advisory as opposed to rules?
Well, we also have a separate rule that does apply. And because we, in that case, we do have certain explicit statutory authority with respect to real estate lending that allowed us to issue a rule. Part of that rule expressly says that you can't lend to someone solely on the liquidation value of the security to do a predatory loan. Mm-hmm. But these advisories were done, I wasn't there at the time, and why we chose to go the route here rather than do a different way, I couldn't say.
Yeah. Looking back, was it a does it still make sense that these were advisories?
Yeah, I want to be clear on something. I think, you know, the way I define the world, there's predatory lending, there's subprime lending, there's Alt-A lending, and there's prime lending. Mm-hmm. Predatory lending was the stuff, the really abusive stuff that was going on that involved equity stripping, loans that were just plainly abusive on their face, were excuses to get the thing from coming, knowing they default, get their whole hands on the property and stop it. And it started to go on. As house prices started to rise, it became a business for people to do it. And we saw it, were very concerned about it, issued a number of issuances to go directly after that. And we kept that out of the national banking system. That did not occur. You pointed to some general language, mm-hmm. which can be interpreted, I think, to have a kind of broader, more general meeting. But that was the essence of a bunch of these things, and we think that it worked quite successfully through advisors, through guidance, through examination, through the regulation. I think it's a separate question when you get to subprime lending, which was not what we just described about, but had features that ultimately proved quite bad in terms of the underwriting being weak, and people ultimately not being able to repay the loans. Mm-hmm. And this kind of stuff, I think, was less relevant to that. We viewed that as things that were not the most prudent things in the world. We would definitely supervise the institutions mm-hmm. about how they would conduct it. And as a result, even the large banking organizations that decided to get into that business tended not to do it in the bank. In that chart I showed you, they tended to do it in a separate company. It's not true for all of them. There were exceptions to that. Mm-hmm. But they tended not to do it inside the bank. And it was true of the state banks as well as the national banks. It tended to be done in holding company affiliates. And the holding company affiliate was not subject to rigorous supervision. And even though the Fed had jurisdiction and the states had jurisdiction, it never got subject to bank-like examination. And as a result, it's why Citi had its entity, its subprime mortgage lender, Citi Financial, was outside the bank. Same thing was true with Household Financial when they bought HSBC, when they bought Household Financial.
Right.
The mortgage piece stayed outside the bank, never went inside the bank. So
is that also true for Wells and Bank of America?
Bank of America, I think, was in subprime lending many years ago, but had gotten out of it as a direct lender. Now, they ended up with some CDO stuff at the end, but they were not as much of a direct lender. Wells was a bit of a split case, is my recollection. They did have an entity that was directly and only focused on subprime lending called Wells Fargo Financial, I believe. But they also had a mortgage lender that they did move into the bank that did do some subprime lending.
Right.
So they had kind of a split was my thing.
And wasn't there a, there was a case or an administrative matter involving the OCC vis-a-vis California, correct, in terms of Wells and its mortgage lender? I mean, you preempted the state of California. Was that the context?
I don't know if that was the mortgage lending thing. There was definitely a case, there were definitely a couple of cases involving mm-hmm. Wells and preemption that predated my time here at the OCC, and it could have been more funny. I'm not sure. I'd have to get back to you on that.
Okay. But if I went back to that, that would be a subsidiary of
and if it
bank.
Once was in the bank, it was subject to preemption. I doubt about that. But as I said, a huge chunk stayed outside and was not subject to preemption and was subject to regulation by both the state and by the Federal Reserve. So it was only the piece that went in either directly or in the subsidiary. And I would say overall, because of all that, and I know these numbers are disputed by others, but the actual share of subprime lending done by national banks was relatively small to the overall market.
It is less than 40%.
It's not 40%. It's less than 15% is what we and
I've seen different figures. Do you have a source that?
Yeah, and here's what we're going to do, because Bart asked these same questions. We will provide for the testimony an appendix that walks through how we got our numbers both then and the more recent estimates, why we think they are what they are, and why we think some of the other estimates that people have talked about are not as accurate. Part of the problem here is that there are no common definitions for subprime. People define things differently.
We've run into that problem ourselves.
And part of the problem is also, it's hard, this thing I talked about, that chart I showed you.
Subprime versus predatory versus.
But the chart of who's actually issuing the loans, people often confuse the holding company affiliate mm-hmm. with the bank when they run the statistics together. You've got to really parse them out, and that's not always clear to do, but we will lay all that out. Show you exactly what they do. So our numbers were lower, is my point. And we believe in those numbers, we believe they're right.
Okay. Speaking of numbers, in terms of actions you took in the examination process mm-hmm. vis-a-vis subprime or predatory lending or Alt-A lending, are there records of that? I mean, I'm specifically interested in how these advisories were translated into examinations and were in turn translated into directives to banks or financial institutions to do something different.
I'll have to get back to you on the specifics of, there certainly are records when we do exams based on the specific procedures, but since I was here when we issued the non-traditional mortgage guidance in 2005 or 2006, I know that we took that guidance. We did a horizontal review, and I think we can provide documentation to show that we did that in some cases. It resulted in what we call matters requiring attention to make sure people were complying with the guidance. But yes, if people weren't doing it, we had to take action. There would be a trail showing that.
Okay. It would be particularly interesting, I think, if we had some information that related those facts to the firms that required significant TARP support or
would you say significant TARP support?
I'm thinking Wells, I'm thinking Wachovia, I'm thinking B of A.
Okay, not just the extraordinary ones you're talking about, the top group, the group that was there for the October meeting on.
Well, some of those were investment banks, but.
But I meant the ones of ours that were those.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so that, I think you had four of the top nine, four of the top ten. I may be misstating that, but.
So we had that meeting. We had Wells, B of A, Citi, J.P. Morgan, maybe a
Wachovia.
They were gone.
Okay.
But they had, they weren't. Morgan Stanley was not a national bank then. Mm-hmm. That's not true. You're right, Kelly. So do you want Morgan Stanley too? They had.
Sure.
They became a national bank on September 28th or whatever it was.
Right.
A month before they got that money. And so I'm not sure. That's. Honestly, I wouldn't. It'll be. They really weren't involved in the mortgage lending business, weren't around as a national bank until that moment. There's not going to be much there, but. Yeah, and they're really not in that, but they do.
Yeah, I mean, if it's not inconvenient, that would be terrific. I mean, the ones I'm particularly interested in are the ones that got significant federal taxpayer support and that had been real regulatees for the period within which all these guys got into trouble.
That's okay. That's more the top of the four that you're talking about. Right?
Yeah.
Are you looking for actions such as matters requiring attention and more formal enforcement actions that related to the topics of these advisories?
Yes.
From the date of the advisories forward?
Right. That would be most helpful. I mean, what we're trying to get some sense of is, there were clearly, one of the apparent triggers of the crisis was these kinds of loans, whether you define it as subprime or Alt-A or predaceous lending. And, what were the regulators doing vis-a-vis those activities, particularly in the broader context in which at least some portions of those activities were walled off from state review.
Okay.
So, it's basically what, you may have given notices and notices of correction across a broad swath, and it'd be interesting to know that, but given the time we all have, I'd be particularly interested in the biggest ones. But this does raise at least another question, which is, since you recall, were these kinds of efforts within the examination process to identify these kinds of problems and correct them, was that the bulk of the OCC's activity in this, with respect to these kinds of problems, or were we also taking affirmative enforcement steps?
When we had to, we did.
Okay.
But I think we always start with the notion of, are you doing this, anything like this, what are you doing, you shouldn't be doing this, or you should be doing it in this way. This is the stuff we would aim this at, is the really abusive stuff that was going on that really hadn't emerged in a big way in the national banking system. We don't think it ever really made it in. We showed up in other places. We had a bunch of subprime credit card lenders, and we had to take a bunch of actions against them, to the point where we ran all the monoline subprime credit card lenders out of the system. People were issuing secured credit cards, people were the payday lenders. But on the mortgage space, it didn't get to that point, except in a couple of instances, is my recollection. But we were
terrific. And do you have any specific, as you sit there, do you have any recollections of those two? I mean, were they since they were?
I don't. It didn't happen while I was here, except for maybe, there was a case, the Laredo case, and I can't remember whether that involved mortgages or just secured credit cards.
Oh, that's the small bank in Texas?
Yes.
That one?
Yeah, right. But we can get that for you.
Okay. That would be superb. Now, there was a 1999 rule with respect to visitorial rights.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any involvement in that one?
No.
As a practitioner? And as I understand it, while you have been comptroller, however, you have used that rule to foreclose activities by state AGs and state regulators.
Yes. It's on the books, and I think, I don't know if we've formally used it to, to do things, but we certainly had the litigation against Governor Spitzer that was pending when I got here, that also took place before I got here.
Right. But I have been chatting with your staffer, Leslie Bridgman, who's actually been very responsive, by and large. But do you have data sets in terms of the number of amicus briefs you did, the number of occasions in which you might have intervened on behalf of OCC-regulated entities vis-a-vis
on visitation questions?
Right.
Yeah, I'm sure we can get that.
That would be most helpful. Okay. That would be most helpful.
Well, we've had conversations with, I think, both of you about the interpretation of the subpoena. I think Linda Bridgman has talked with you about it, and we're collecting the data that you requested pursuant to the interpretations you gave us on the subpoena. So,
right.
And our understanding...
It should catch it, is my impression.
Yes, that's right.
But if there are, if there are summaries that you might have prepared for the Hill or for your own management efforts, I think those would be encompassed by the request. But since we're here and I can clarify, I'd like to do that.
I think that's right.
Yeah. Okay. And since it was in the papers over the weekend, any personal perspectives on Capital One and the state of West Virginia?
Yeah, I would say I think that was a completely unfair characterization of what happened on the Capital One situation. First of all, they acquired, early on when I was here, they ended up acquiring two banks. And once they acquired these two banks, one in Louisiana, which was a national bank, Iberia National Bank, and one in New York, which was a state-chartered bank, they had the unenviable pleasure of having all four federally regulated charters at once. They had a state member bank that was the credit card bank that they had. They had a national bank that operated in Louisiana. They had a state non-member bank in New York. And that non-member banking organization also owned a thrift. So they made the decision at that time they were going to put them all together as one charter and operate the thing in a streamlined way to get a single regulator. They did that. That took them a while to execute. During that process, there was a complaint filed or investigation going on by West Virginia and by California about things. But the notion that they flipped charters to avoid this action in West Virginia is frankly ridiculous. Now, we take very seriously the notion that they had these things pending. We did reach out both to California and to West Virginia to say, what do you have? What is it that's happening? We will look into these, and where we agree that this is a problem, we will take action. With respect to West Virginia, they provided a bunch of different things that they thought were going on. We investigated three of them. We agreed with one of them. We took action about it, not just with respect to customers in West Virginia, but all over the country. And it's a restitution. They didn't like how far we went. There are other matters that they also refer to us that are still under investigation that we're looking at, and we think that's appropriate. We have tried to reach out to the states to talk about specifically what they're doing and as we take those things on.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it your practice, there's no right answer to this question, but I'd understood from one of your folk that if there was a problem pending at the state level and someone wants to move their charter from the state regulator to you guys, that is held up until that state matter, that state problem is resolved?
Not necessarily. We certainly wouldn't lift it. So we might take the bank over and keep the document on the bank and make sure that they comply with whatever. So, for example, in the same matter,
Capital One.
If Capital One, when they acquired North Fork Bank had either an affiliate called Greenpoint, which was a thrift, and they were engaged in some questionable mortgage activities. And there was a document pending, is my understanding. And when we took it over, we said, we will allow the merger to go through, but we will keep the document on that institution. And we did that. And shortly thereafter, as a matter of fact, both because of what we were doing and because of what happened in the crisis, they ceased doing operations. And that would be the normal thing. We do not, if you look at the history, if you would be happy to furnish you with the Washington Post article, it is much more often the case, had been much more often the case, that banks under our supervision flipped to state charters to get away from potential regulatory actions to go to the state.
Just a point of clarification, they ceased operations, they being Greenpoint.
And since I've been here, just so you know, the way the charter flips have gone, there have been many more from national to state and state to national. So we as regulators finally adopted something that said, you know, a common statement so that people couldn't jump a charter to avoid a regulatory action, which I thought was a good idea. Totally support.
What is your sense? I mean, this is a little bit orthogonal to our conversation today, but it is an issue. And that is the question of charter competition.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you are certainly an informed observer of that, I would think. Do you have general perspectives on whether that exists, and secondly, what the factors might be that support either regulatory charter competition or regulatory arbitrage?
Mm-hmm. And sort of, well, first of all, I think it's a perfectly legitimate thing to be concerned about and to watch out for that it doesn't get abused. But we've also had a dual banking system since 1864, mm-hmm. and it's been, you know, a hallowed thing in the banking law, the banking system that we have. So it's inevitable when you have a dual banking system that there will be differences and people will make choices about one or the other because of those differences. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that unless it's done for the wrong reasons, like shopping to avoid a regulatory action. I do think there are legitimate reasons that you would want a national charter under the system, so you have one set of rules that applies to you no matter where you go. That's the point of the system. And there are legitimate people and reasons if someone might pick a state because they think that state regulator is more in tune. Perhaps we would disagree with this, but more in tune with the notions of what's going on in that state, more in tune with the local community, or I may have other features of the charter that are more attractive to the kind of business that it wants to do.
Do examination fees play a part in that at all?
They can. I think that there are a number of state regulators that go around to our banks and pitch to them that their exam fees are lower and they should flip their charter to get a break on their thing. And that's an unfortunate thing, but it's what the system is set up.
So how does one, I mean, I don't know that you do, but how does one in your shoes institutionally respond to that kind of competition?
You know, it's hard because we're not going to go out and compete with lower charter fees. I mean, we just do our thing and we try to say we're better and we're not going to change our standards to lower them to get somebody to flip to us, and we never have since I've been here. We've had a number of institutions come to us and said, well, you know, maybe we'll take you, but let us do a pre-conversion exam, and they've sampled our supervision, said no thank you, and decided not to do it because they didn't want that kind of supervision. Big institutions and smaller institutions. And so, you know, we call them as we see them. And that's been my consistent instructions to people here. There was some trouble before I got here with us putting out a video of the benefits of a national banking charter, got stopped before I got here and said, I'm not doing anything like that.
So now, was this the era, there's a famous comment, which appears actually in the papers in this preemption issue, from Comptroller Hawk to the effect that preemption is one of the great advantages or something, words to that effect, of a national OCC charter?
I think national standards that come from preemption are one of the advantages to a national charter. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's absolutely correct. I mean, you know, I said it. I think particularly for companies that want to operate across state lines and be in different places, the advantages of having a single set of rules uniformly applied, I think, are quite strong. And that's the whole idea behind the national banking charter and the dual banking system. It always has been.
And is your agency completely supported by fees on your regulatees?
Pretty much. I mean, there's some investment income, but, you know, like, and the same is true of state banking agencies, and same is true of the FDIC. So, yes, and always has been.
And is there any sort of backup line of credit, if you will, with the federal government? I mean, if you're short an amount in a particular year,
you know,
there is a fund that is tucked away someplace that would help you? Or?
Well, of course, we make sure we have prudent reserves to plan for contingencies, but and whether we have an official line of credit with the Treasury, I'm not so sure. Do we? So, not to my knowledge, but
okay. And do you have a sense of approximately what your reserves looks like?
I don't have it off the tip of my tongue, but we can get that to you.
That'd be great.
It's a matter of public information.
Now, were you surprised that Justice Scalia referred to the agency's views on preemption as odd? Actually, he said bizarre, but
I'm not going to characterize Justice
Scalia. I say you're under the cone of silence, but that probably wouldn't be correct.
I will say this. I think I was not surprised. I think the context there that he was talking about, if I remember, it's from memory, not under oath, was the notion of the OCC enforcing a non-preempted state law.
Mm-hmm.
Was the as opposed to the basic idea of enforcing federal law. And I think that was the part that he found unusual, mm-hmm. whatever his adjective was.
Yeah, and I must admit, I had a perspective in the case in my prior roles, but what, from a federal perspective, what was the rationale for that portion of the 99 rule?
I mean, it's what the statute says. I mean, you know, the idea was that you know, the National Banks for was and always had been, from the very beginning, and had been litigated many times to be protected from interference from the states in various different guises. If it amounted to something like an examination or visitation, and over the years there were discussions about what's the scope of that. And it did not distinguish with respect to the type of laws that it applied to, and we were applying the statute in that. You know, that's what the rationale is all in there in the briefs.
But this was obviously before your time, but the visitorial powers includes enforcement. That was brand new, wasn't it? Circa 1999?
Absolutely not. I mean, it was codified in regulation. It's in the statute since 1864.
But wasn't it also the case that state regulation, state consumer protection, existed side by side with National Bank Act regulation till roughly the mid-1990s?
No, we would not agree with that. And I think there were differing views on the history of that. I've seen the history that some of the states have put out with that. We would not agree that there was this notion that all consumer protection regulation provided, and there was this sharp cutoff when the regulation was issued. I think what we would say is, if you go look back on years of precedent, after individual case, there were places that we took a different issue, we had a case-by-case interpretation, and by the time we got to 1999, what we tried to do was codify all that in a rule that basically said, if it's the banking activity, the banking power of the company, that's what are the things that want not to be interfered with on the substantive preemption. We acknowledge at the same time there are lots of other things that don't go to its banking activities, you know, its zoning, you know, general stuff, contracts, etc. There were people saying that you need to clarify what this is, and that's what the attempt was there to do. And that was true for both that side of it and the procedural enforcement visitorial power side from our. Now, it wasn't there, but that's my answer.
Sure. Was there at the time, that period of time, circa late 1990s, was there a developed, as far as you know, sort of strategic litigation program that might have involved this agency plus various national banks to develop your preemptive force?
Not to my knowledge. There were certainly communications back and forth with various litigants, whether they were on the same side of lawsuits as there often is, but I can't speak. I wasn't here then.
Right.
So, but not
anybody in particular on that side of the aisle that might have been a particularly important voice in any kind of debate about how the OCC should grow its authority?
I don't think my understanding of that was there wasn't a notion of growing any authority. It was more a matter of recognizing the authority that was already in the statute that Congress had provided to the agency.
Mm-hmm. But it would be fair to say that at least some folks think that that notion of that perspective on your historic authority was different from what you...
That would be fair to say.
Okay.
That would be fair to say.
All right. Looking forward,
yes.
we obviously have this Cuomo decision. Any perspectives? I mean, I don't want to put you in a difficult spot here, but perspectives on what that may mean in terms of the state-federal relationship going forward?
You know, I think what that applied to was the authority of the states to enforce non-preempted federal laws, and it basically said states can do that. I mean, a particular area that they did it in was, of course, lending discrimination, where we had agreed it was not a preempted lending matter, and I think that's what it speaks to. So I think of those kinds of areas, like lending discrimination, is more a place where you can have overlapping enforcement from state and federal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, since, as I understand it, and keep me correct here, starting with your 2004 rule and then as interpreted in the Georgia decision, essentially your agency preempted a number of state statutes, the Georgia statute being a good example of that. Looking back on it, was that an error? I mean, would it have been better if those statutes had been stayed in place and had been enforceable?
No, I don't think so. I think they were interfered with national banking powers. I don't think the abuses that they were centered on in terms of predatory lending were things that were happening in the national banking system. And so I don't think that, you know, I continue to believe that it's the right thing to have a set of uniform national laws that apply to national banks. I think there should be a stronger set of federal consumer protections that apply across the board to everyone. I think by far the bigger abuses in that area came on institutions that were regulated or not regulated by the states, where huge abuses were going on and nobody was touching them. And I think there was a huge regulatory gap. And I think that really was a problem that needs to be focused on. And it was not a problem due to federal preemption.
Well, let's explore that a little bit.
Okay.
So what were the abuses at the state level you're thinking about?
I mean, the states themselves acknowledged that the really abusive stuff that was going on was happening in entities outside of depository institutions and briefs that they filed, and the equity stripping, all that kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
all that, the things of the Ameriquest and the option ones and the companies that were doing that eventually were the subject of some state attorney general action. Those kinds of companies were ramping up and were at the core of the worst underwritten loans, worst underwritten, not just the predatory lending loans, but the subprime loans mm-hmm. that had the worst delinquency foreclosure rates of any loans in the system. And it was a huge chunk of the system. And to my way of thinking, what we really need is, having a federal consumer protection agency that writes rules across mm-hmm. the board is a very good idea. Applies to federal and state the same way, number one. Number two, that there is an effective compliance mechanism at the state level to make sure that they comply to the same degree as happens at the federal level. And number three, I believe, even more than consumer protection, what we really need are minimum underwriting standards that apply across the board. And that's something that I think should be put into the legislation. It would be a recommendation, if asked, that I would make to the commission. That's something that if we had had real down payments and verified income for mortgage loans, just those two things, I think the scale and scope of this whole crisis would have been reduced.
Yeah. Well, if, as I understand, your ...2003-3 advisory, if that had applied to purchases that actually required certain minimum standards, right?
By national banks
right.
that purchased loans from third parties.
Let me spin something back to you. I mean, my understanding, keep me honest here, would be that the Ameriquest of the world sold their paper other places, so mm-hmm. it went to national banks in
not
the
so
forms
much.
Of RMBS,
not so
which
much.
Was turned into CDOs. It also went to investment banks covered by the Federal Reserve. So there was a huge profit to be made. I mean, I think there are lots of folks who probably bear significant responsibility, but the source of the money were essentially national financial institutions. Do you disagree with that?
I agree with that. I would say that they're, but that's a different thing than some of the national banks that were subject to preemption were the ones that were causing that to happen. I absolutely believe that there were organizations at the federal level that were structuring securities that were buying product originated by the lenders that was just describing wrapping one up in securities and selling it all over the place. Mm-hmm. I do think that.
Yeah. But to get back to something you and I have discussed earlier, when we look at the books and records of Citibank, we see that Citibank itself was a very large financial provider to AmeriQuest. Mm-hmm. And don't you think that there's something analogous to the reputational risk of sort of the Enron kind of scenario? If you've got a national bank making billions of dollars of credit available to an institution you've described as being the provider of, you know, the really bad stuff.
You can. I mean, I understand that thought. But again, if you look at the actual overall amount in the system of the big subprime lenders and who's providing warehouse financing, it's still a pretty relatively small share. It doesn't mean they weren't doing it. They were. Mm-hmm. It also isn't illegal to make loans to people. I mean, as you and I discussed, they're not responsible in a legal sense for the underwriting decisions, just as they're not responsible for a bunch of other things that they lend to, unless they know they're doing something fraudulent or, you know, what have you. And did that play a role, as credit does in anything, in helping to facilitate that activity? Sure. And it did to some extent. But I don't think you can pin, I don't think that's much to do with preemption. I don't think it's an outsized cause of it with what the national banks were doing. But did it help fund some of these operators? Yes.
And isn't that a component of sort of the reputational risk?
It can be if they end up with something that's really bad.
Let's step back briefly. When you spoke to obviously an initiative that you worked on, which is the combined guidance that involved Federal Reserve, yourself, mm-hmm. OTS as well, as I recall. Mm-hmm. Probably would be like a soldier, I would think. But in any case, the major federal agencies. Given the provisions of that common guidance,
yeah.
If that had been the law of the land, would it have been possible for AmeriQuest and Countrywide and the others to have sent all that bad paper into the system?
I think it would have been much harder for them to underwrite the loans in the first instance. I think there have been fewer loans made because there have been fewer borrowers that qualify for the loans.
Right. So, I do not purport to be an expert on the current
right.
guidance, but it appears to have standards in terms of affordability, ultimate ability to pay, and things of that nature that would have, in the context of 228 loans and resets and penalties, et cetera, would have made it extremely difficult for AmeriQuest and the others of their ilk to upstream it to Wall Street or the banks.
Yeah, I think.
Is that something you agree with?
I think if they had the standards, particularly what I mentioned earlier, that you can't qualify or accept it fully indexed, right?
Mm-hmm.
It just would have meant there, and you had to document income on the thing, that would have shut down a bunch of it. Absolutely.
And that's in the standard, as I recall, right?
There's two standards. One guidance. There's the non-traditional mortgage guidance, mm-hmm. which was more for payment option arms and the like. It wasn't really aimed at the subprime market. Then there was the separate subprime guidance, which had similar features. It came out a year later. And had that been done earlier, yes, I think it would have made a very significant difference. And it goes to the point I was talking about earlier. It had some parts of it that was more for pure consumer protection, but the part that I think that was most important is the minimum underwriting standard part of it, because it would have meant that the loans would have been on their face harder for someone to suggest that they could pay the money back. And many fewer people would have qualified for the loans, and that would have just shrunk the whole size of the market, stopped it from mushrooming, if it did.
Okay. Now, those from the more conservative side of the political spectrum would suggest that sort of Big Brother-esque. Do you have a perspective on that?
Yeah, my perspective on it is, normally, and this was a hard one. That's why, and I think it was part of the reason why it took long for this to get adopted and why it wasn't as effective, that normally the way the system had worked was if you had a willing buyer and a willing seller, and it wasn't imperiling the health of the financial institution, then normally you would let something go ahead if it was adequately disclosed and the like. I think the abusive loans don't meet that standard because I don't think they're adequately disclosed. But I think there are other loans that weren't consumer protection questions. There were issues of credit that was just too easy and people wanted the money. They wanted to buy the house. And too much easy credit started happening. And I guess what I would say, and I've written on this subject, is whatever we did, we lost our way. And we got to a place where credit got way too easy across the board. Mm-hmm. And when you have something that dysfunctional occur, that is when the government needs to step in and put in some minimum standards. And that's why I support, and it's not something that's particularly popular at the moment, but to have the government come in and set some. Now, they should, I don't believe they should set every minimum. I don't think they should do every, you know, set what FICO score should, you know, come and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But some basic things, a real down payment, verify the income. You know, if it was me, I would do recourse lending, which is, you know, it's not permitted in your state.
Mm-hmm. But it number is, states, yeah.
Rest. But in my state, I mean, every mortgage I've ever signed did it, and, you know, the Europeans think we're crazy, and they've got a point. I think there are a bunch of things that if you'd had it at the start, it just would have so reduced the size of the problem. Mm-hmm. So reduced the size of the problem. So that's where I come out on it.
And having been part of the process that developed this common guidance, what took so long?
Well, the first one we got out, I mean, we got here in August 2005. We got their draft out in, I don't know, December or January. Mm-hmm. But there was an agreement among the regulators, and it took a long time to get people on board, and we had to push really hard. And then when the subprime guidance came along, too, it took a while for get people to get agreement on that in the wake of this. I wish we'd gone sooner on that, in retrospect, on both of them. But sometimes when you have four people trying to get it done and people arguing against it, it takes time to get a consensus, and that's what happened.
Okay. Given where you think the purchasing power was, harking back to about six questions ago, not from your perspective in the regulated OCC banks, but in the investment banks and other places.
Which could have been affiliated, I mean, part of the state or part of the bank, whatever.
Is it the Federal Reserve that bears more of the responsibility than the OCC for what happened here?
Well, they had a different, I'm not going to sit around pointing fingers, but I think others, I think there are a couple of things. One, in that structure I just described to you.
Yes.
When you have an entity on this side of the line that's not a bank, the Fed regulates them and the state, but it's really the Fed. And for years, they took a deliberate decision, conscious decision, that they wouldn't, even if it was engaging in the exact same credit activity here as the bank was engaging here, they would not supervise it as a bank and apply the same credit standards or the same loan loss reserve standards for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's appropriate. And I think that had the subprime arms been subject to the same rules as what the bank was subject, it would have helped. And it's one of the recommendations that we've made going forward that I think is right, that the lead supervisor in a bank holding company of the bank should regulate, have the ability to regulate the credit activities, the same kinds of credit activities wherever they're done in the organization, so you don't have this potential arbitrage effect. Now, I think, so that's one point. Second point is the Fed did have rulemaking authority in the area of subprime lending.
Is this the HOPA authority, mm-hmm. or you're thinking about
the HOPA authority?
Okay. Which is also safety and soundness powers, right. I'm curious about.
But now I'm talking about the HOPA authority, okay. Where they specifically could use it, that in combination with their unfair and deceptive rulemaking authority, to do something that went across the board that applied not just to this and not just to this, but also to the AmeriQuest and the Option 1s would apply to all of them. And it's kind of the, but it's subprime, and they have now since issued such a reg. But if that had been done earlier, that really could have made a difference. Mm-hmm. Absolutely could have made a difference.
Now, there was a moment, Federal Reserve Order Governor
Gramlich
had a famous dust-up with Mr. Greenspan on presumably this point. Was that a point, potential point?
It was early enough that it would have made a difference. I mean, the real ramp-up was in, I don't know, from 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, that era was when the subprime market, the securitization market just mushroomed. Mm-hmm. And I recollection, I just thought I wasn't here at that. It was around that time where they were getting concerned about it, and they could have done something in that area. But they've had the power since 1994. I think it goes back to an earlier point you were making that we were talking about earlier, whereas I think there had been a general reluctance to prescribe specific underwriting standards, which got in the way of willing buyers and willing sellers. So if you can separate this a little bit, and we're now in hindsight and everything's gone bad.
Sure, of course.
But if you roll back to then, there were a lot more people getting credit. A lot more people getting credit. There were a lot more people buying houses. And there was a school of thought that said, that's not such a bad thing. If there are people who are willing to do this, and we've got a market system that is working to get credit in their hands, that's a good thing for people. Mm-hmm. The problem was, it wasn't such a good thing. It was the way the system worked. They were getting credit they shouldn't have gotten. And as a result, it created a bubble and fed on itself and ended up exploding. That's pretty bad. But the minute you start running in and setting rules and floors, you're going to deny some people credit. Particularly take a place like California with really high mortgages, you start talking about 5% down payments, that'll wipe a bunch of people out of even being eligible. And so it creates, there's a whole set of pressures there, but we clearly got too carried away, my belief, in a system that was seeming to help everybody in one sense, getting access to credit and buying homes and the like, in ways that one piece of it was, could be abusive, but even at the other piece where people walked in with their eyes open, they just wanted to get it, and lied about their income or what have you, and to get it. I think it created an unsustainable system that helped feed the bubble, that helped make everything worse in the end when it came down. There has to be some basic discipline in the system. That's what I hope we go back to, is we go back to a basic system that, at least when I was young, you had to put a down payment down, and they got your W-2s. And I just think, a lot of that basic common sense stuff, it's not the whole answer, but it's a big part of it. Mm-hmm. And it ought to be part of what we're doing, and it ought to apply across the board. So we can't have somebody end run the system, put pressure on the other guys. So that's my 2 cents on it.
Okay, good 2 cents. But let me give you the opportunity. There are state regulators and state AGs that would make some version of the following statement, that but for OCC preemption, predatory lending laws in their states, regulation, licensing requirements of lenders, this would have been a very, very different world. What's your perspective on that?
If I thought had seen an explosion of subprime lending going on inside national bank lenders, I would buy that argument. I would say people were shifting stuff into national banks in order to do all this abusive stuff and do all this subprime lending. But that's not what we saw. And most of it was still going on outside, which the states were absolutely free to regulate. We had no control over the Ameriquest and people were doing that. And I recognize that they would make the argument, well, that's not fair because the other guys aren't subject to the same rules. But if the other guys aren't doing the same things, then I'm having trouble with the argument. You look at this chart, and you tally up all the loans. 75% of the loans in the subprime and Alt-A, roughly, according to our numbers, were made by either exclusively state-regulated companies, by holding company affiliates that were subject to state regulation, by state banks or state operating subsidiaries. It's a relatively small part that was subject to federal preemption. And so I'm not saying they were blameless. We had people who were doing some of the stuff, and the ones who were doing it were just subject to the same kind of problems as others. But I don't think it drove the whole thing in the other part. I think it was overwhelming market force, and I don't think there's enough people on the ground in the states to go after it. Mm-hmm. And just as I think this was a failure that we didn't at the federal level adopt standards across the board, and that we didn't supervise in the holding company affiliates. And so I think there's blame to go around. I don't want to say we're blameless, we are not. But I don't think that federal preemption caused this crisis. I think that, you know, I just don't think that's right. And for the reasons I've just described.
Okay. Let me step back briefly, because you are, I may be getting this title incorrectly. Aren't you the chair of the forum? There's some international.
The joint forum.
The joint
not
forum.
Anymore, right?
Not anymore. Okay. But I'd just like to ask a couple of questions in terms of your international role. From that perch, what did we do wrong? What happened here? I mean, you've already spoken to some of this, but if there's something else you'd like to share with us.
Well, we did a, there's a particular report that we did about gaps in supervision across countries that contributed to the crisis and things that we need to look at. And there are a bunch of things. I mean, you know, things related to one of the pieces that I worked hard to get into the report. I think all countries should have, you're not going to be surprised to hear this now, minimum mortgage underwriting standards.
Right. They're
different in different places. But I think it's important that people watch it because, you know, housing bubbles are going on in different parts of the world. And people, I gave a speech on this in Japan, and somebody raised their hand and said, but this stuff seems pretty obvious. And I said, yeah, well, you know.
Had to be there.
That's
yeah.
what people thought 20 years ago, where we are too. So, so I think there was that. I mean, you know, there were clear gaps in the United States on the systemic supervision where it was a bank-centric model, and there was much more regulation focused on banks and bank holding companies than there were on investment banks and insurance companies. And banks definitely played their role in it, but it really started outside with some huge problems, and we should never have a system again where you can't get information from systemically significant companies that are not banks. You can't regulate them if they get it. Mm-hmm. Become systemically significant, critical thing of the crisis. It's not as much of a pressing issue right now because all of those companies either failed, were taken over by the government, taken over by banks, or switched to bank holding companies. So right now you can sort of count on fewer than the fingers of one hand institutions that might mm-hmm. you know, meet that test. But going forward, you got to have that authority, the government does. And I think that's one of the things that people talk about. There's a lot of anger outside the United States and what happened here and how it spread to there, and a lot of it's related to mortgages and subprime mortgages, which is again goes back to the first principles that we talked to about. I think there are issues. I think the thing that stunned everybody was the liquidity in the system. That is to say, everybody had come to rely on this very liquid market for securities, commercial paper and the like, and no one had planned for what would happen if it shut down. In the old world, in which banks had to hold much more cash on their balance sheets to deal with that kind of situation, was something that was not a world in which they were living, and they're going to have to hold more liquidity. But this gets hard, because if you hold more liquidity and you hold more capital, which is the other mm-hmm. piece of it, you don't make as many loans. Mm-hmm. And if you're in a worldwide recession, people start putting pressure. So more capital, more liquidity, stronger underwriting standards, derivatives, you know, credit default swaps and the like, moving more towards more transparency, moving more towards central clearing, having something to deal with institutions that are too big to fail, a resolution mechanism. It's the same cluster of issues that we deal with here in the United States, but people have different, you know, reactions and responses to it.
Can I ask just a point of clarification?
Sure.
Were you essentially saying that the functional regulation component of Gramm-Leach-Bliley was a part of the problem?
No, I don't. No? I mean, I think it's an... It was... Well, let me back up. It certainly was not a problem between bank regulators and the Federal Reserve. I think there was an issue between... the ability to go into the broker dealer by the Fed, even if it was a consolidated regulator. I think that was an issue. And they've argued, and Treasury's argued, you should pull off that restriction in Graham Leach Bliley that defers totally to the functional regulator. I think that's overstated. I think the bigger issue was the holding company itself of Bear Stearns, was not subject to Fed regulations. They have the same ability to go in and force them to do stuff right from the very beginning. They had to walk on tiptoes until they really got into trouble, and then they were able to go in. So I don't think it was so much that, but that definitely needs some adjustment. Okay.
Just one other question. National City, did they have a different structure with
They were all here. They were all here. Now that's when I said that we had one through, that definitely was one that clearly was one where we had both the bank and the sub of the bank.
So First Franklin was a sub of the bank?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and that one was clearly subject to federal preemption. And they clearly did some things.
Didn't do a good thing.
Got into trouble and did a bad job, and that was kind of the most glaring example. Although they sold that company to Merrill Lynch, and now we have it back again because Bank of America fought Merrill
Lucky
Lynch.
Lucky you.
Yeah. So all those things came back to the system, but no, that's right. That's the one specific example.
All right. I just want to loop back on a couple of questions. There have been expressed concerns about the number of OCC enforcement actions that result in restitution to consumers.
Mm-hmm.
Any perspectives on that? I mean, the suggestion would be some version of they are not very aggressive regulators because there are relatively few restitution results when they do things, and the further perspective is that OCC only comes in when somebody else has started an inquiry.
Heard both those things.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
So I think our perspective is fits the premise is wrong in a sense. By the time we get to an enforcement action, that means we've gone through a bunch of other things that didn't work. Mm-hmm. And it's our hope, and we believe our job, that we examine first and enforce only if we have to, and try to get corrective action and accomplish that way. So a good example is the non-traditional mortgages and payment options. That's, we saw there was an issue. We said you have to do it this way. We made people comply with it. We didn't have the same problems in that area, and so we didn't need to take enforcement actions in the area. Now, someone could come along and say, hey, you've never taken enforcement action for payment option mortgages. And I'd say, well, yeah, that's right, because we achieved what we wanted to achieve through the supervisory process. So I don't think you can measure how effective we are as a consumer protection regulator solely by the amount of enforcement actions we take. It is true in a world that you come from, that's how you get at it. It's an enforcement model, and you've got to go out there, and that's how you measure things. So we take some when we need to, and when we think we have to, and we hope we achieve the kind of behavior affecting action through our extensive examination and supervisory process, so they don't engage in the activities that require restitution.
But if you are, I mean, obviously on a going forward basis, that certainly resonates with me, but in terms of working backwards,
yeah.
I mean, not to tout records at the state level, but if when we're looking at the world from that perspective, you would look at countrywide, which is over a billion, household, which was 480 million, AmeriQuest, which I think is 398 million. What, when you find something that has gone on for a while, what is your enforcement perspective with respect to the appropriateness of
this? Yeah, well, then it's very appropriate. I mean, and then we go in and we take action, and if we have to do big, large fines, we will do it. And we've done a lot of it. Not as much as, I mean, we've done big ones. And so, you know, in the countrywide kind of circumstance, look at, remember, we only had the bank, and then they left us. But the subprime stuff was going on outside the bank.
Mm-hmm.
Household, the same thing. That was outside the bank. HSBC was doing stuff, didn't do its subprime activity in the bank. They did it in a holding company affiliate. So we would argue part of the reason why, even though there was federal preemption, you didn't see as much of the subprime activity go into it, is that it wasn't a particularly receptive climate. Now, I think part of that was we had taken quite an aggressive set of actions in the subprime credit card area, which demonstrated what we were prepared to do as part of our enforcement program if we had to do it. We took a number of them, and they were quite significant. I think people understood that our attitude towards subprime credit was going to be different than what they would get in a holding company affiliate or somewhere else, including on the reserving side, where we would, you know, maintain substantial reserves. So I don't, again, you know, it is one measure. It's hard to prove the negative, which is why people keep coming after us, but we believe that we can achieve a lot of corrective action and preventive action by doing it at the supervisory level.
Okay. Thank you very much.
This is
very helpful.
Thank you.